Coming up next on the program, a cold case in L.A., some revealing videotape, and an unsolved murder from 26 years ago. I'm Dick Gordon from APM American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. 26 years ago, a young woman was murdered in California. Police didn't have a lot to go on. The night that Sherry Rasmussen was killed, she was home. Her husband found her. She'd been shot 3 times in the chest. The BMW she'd parked outside was gone. At the time, detectives assumed it was a burglary gone bad. There were a couple of peculiarities. For example, there was a bite mark on the victim's arm. Someone took a swab of that, but the investigation turned up no leads and was soon set aside. A cold case. Matt McGuff is a former writer for the TV show Law & Order who wound up writing about the Rasmussen murder. At the time that swab was taken, there was no such thing as DNA in a detective's toolkit. But as we all know, that changed.
So in early 2005, a criminalist in the LAPD crime lab picked up the request from the cold case unit to analyze this evidence and saw a notation indicating that there was this swab taken from the bite mark of Rasmussen's left arm more than 20 years previously. And when that evidence was tested, it was revealed that it was a mixture of two individuals' DNA. One of them was confirmed to be Rasmussen's, and the second one was unknown in that it was not an individual whose DNA profile was in CODIS, which is the FBI's national
It wasn't on file
database. Since the late 90s, DNA analysis of this type has revealed the gender of the donor. And in this case, it was also female.
Which changed everything.
It did. Because it does conflict, obviously, with the original theory of the crime. In early 2009, the case had been transferred back to Van Nuys Division, which is, you know, the geographic division within the LAPD where the murder had occurred all those years before. And it was those detectives who realized for the first time that, wait a second, if we know that the saliva in this bite mark is from a female, then that doesn't the original theory of the case must not have been right.
So how did they zero in on this L.A. police officer? How did she come back into their consideration?
Well, it took quite a bit of time for them to, she was noted in the original case notes, but kind of in an oblique fashion, not
as
her
a
first
former
name.
Girlfriend or something like that.
Basically, no name. Just was her first initial last name. It said something like verified S. Lazarus as ex girlfriend, and then it said P.O. And the detective who opened the case file didn't even realize initially that P.O. was an abbreviation for police officer. He reached out to the husband of Sherry Rasmussen, who has since remarried, and was interviewing him and asking him about women who may have had some motive or was interviewing him about the case. And it was the husband who said, my ex-girlfriend, who was an LAPD officer. Suddenly it made sense to the Van Nuys detectives what that notation in the case notes was.
And once they determined that she was perhaps the most likely suspect, Matt, how careful did they have to be in terms of letting anyone within the department or other people know that they were steering their investigation in this direction?
Well, very careful. They were very, very concerned, I think, throughout about the possibility of there being a leak. Or that she may learn that she was being investigated. And, I think there was also an element of, believing it unlikely that she did it and thus not wanting to, drag her name through the mud. I mean, she's a respected veteran LAPD detective.
Did they even have her DNA on file so they could make a cross-reference without her knowing?
They don't.
So what do they do in this case?
Well, you know, they, because of the concern about leaks, they numbered the, you know, they made a list, and they made Lazarus number 5. And they never referred to her by name. So every notation they made in the book and on their whiteboard and speaking of her, they only referred to her as number 5. So she was trailed while running errands, and they collected a straw and a cup that she had been drinking from. And a DNA profile was harvested from saliva on the straw and compared to the DNA profile, they matched.
And that was enough for what at that point, Matt, for them to question her or?
Well, I think once they got those results back, that was enough, obviously, you know, to arrest her. I mean, you know, at that point, she really did become, I mean, she was the prime suspect in the case. Now, obviously, as this is all going on, she has no idea that she's being investigated and investigated, in fact, by detectives who are working 50 feet from her own desk. I mean, this is all unfolding really on the third floor of LAPD headquarters.
And we're talking, you know, about a crime that was committed 23 years earlier, right? So to just steer the conversation in that direction would be a delicate thing. There's a part in your story where you talk about these two detectives, Greg Stearns and Dan Jaramillo, who are figuring out how to question her. What did they do? What is it that they wind up concluding will work?
Well, you know, the challenge for Detective Stearns and Jaramillo was to question Lazarus in a way, first of all, that would not put, you know, her, her family, or the detectives in danger.
And what was the plan?
So Stearns and Jaramillo, you know, there's a jail division that was on the second floor of Parker Center LAPD headquarters. And the custom in interviewing suspects there was all detectives would have to surrender their firearms before they could enter this secure area of headquarters. So early on the morning of June 5, 2009, shortly after she arrived at her desk, Detective Jaramillo approached Detective Lazarus at her desk, and he told her that there was a suspect on the second floor who claimed to know something about an art theft case, and asking for Lazarus to come downstairs and basically to see if this guy was for real. And she agreed, and the two detectives rode the elevator down a floor, and both surrendered their firearms, as was the custom, at the door to the jail division. And then he walked her to the interview room, and, you know, obviously there was no suspect waiting there. It was only Jaramillo's partner waiting there.
The two detectives turned on a video camera to question their own colleague. They knew that she was once involved with the husband of the victim. And at this point, 23 years had passed since that murder. And the tape of that interrogation was made public.
We've been assigned a case that we've been looking at.
Okay.
Denise, and reviewing the case, there's some notes to see as far as your name being mentioned. Do you know John Rutten?
John Rutten?
Rutten.
Oh, yeah, I went to school with him.
You did?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we were good friends.
Was there ever any relationship or anything that developed between you guys?
Yeah, I mean, we dated. No. I mean, what's this all about?
Well, it's relating to his wife.
Okay.
Okay. Did you know her?
Not really. I mean, I knew that he got married years ago.
Matt McGough is the one who's explaining this case for us. He's a lawyer and was a writer for the TV show Law & Order, so he knows his way around a courtroom. And he says he was surprised when the judge released that videotape.
I'm not familiar with another case in which this type of material is public, but, you know, the judge in the case did make it public. But in this hearing last fall, when the admissibility of this statement was debated, when, you know, the judge announced that he was going to to release it, you know, the prosecutor responded by saying, release the transcript or the video. And I'm sitting in court, and it's the first that I hear that there's even video.
What's this got to do with me dating him and, you know, her getting killed? I mean, I don't have anything to do with it. And you got something that's, somebody said, you know, whatever. I mean,
well, like we said, we just literally got this the other day, and you're going through it.
Yeah.
And you see,
somebody's
your name.
It's next door.
Right. And so, you know, I mean, obviously it's like we recognize the name, and we know that, you know, you work next door to us. And so we're trying to get some background. We're trying to figure this out.
You know, it's important to note, you know, I don't think, you know, even though it's obviously incredibly dramatic material, you know, Stearns and Jaramillo, and I think a lot of, you know, a lot of people in the LAPD don't regard it as, you know, I mean, they regard the case as a, well, yeah, I mean, you know, it's also important to note Lazarus doesn't admit anything in the tape. People can, you know, it's publicly available. I think
right.
there's
and she's pleading not guilty to the
yeah,
charge
she's,
against
she's
her.
She's steadfastly maintained her innocence, you know, from the time of her arrest. So
is there a point in the tape, Matt, which particularly caught your attention?
Well, I mean, it's what's most interesting to me about the tape is that, and again, as a former writer for Law and Order, you know, I think I'm conditioned, and I think, you know, generally, just by virtue of how many police procedurals are out there and how familiar that form is, that, you know, we expect there's going to be like some kind of a gotcha moment.
Yeah.
What's really interesting, and I think it's to the credit of Detective Stearns and Jaramillo, is they don't interview their colleague in an accusatory way. To the contrary, they come at her in a way that leaves her uncertain whether they're interviewing her as a witness or as a suspect. And that's important because it makes it very difficult for her to know how much they know. You know, it seems like it puts her in a posture where if she were to cut off the questioning, you know, that it may raise a red flag in and of itself. I mean, if they're just asking her questions that as a witness that, hey, your name popped up with regard to this case and it may be nothing and we just wanted to ask you some questions about it, for her to, you know, to clam up or to, you know, say, I want a lawyer, maybe in her mind, you know, will make her look like a suspect. So it's this dynamic where they're kind of coming at her in this very oblique way that is designed, I think, to keep her talking.
I mean, if you guys are claiming that I'm a suspect, then, you know, I got a problem with, you know, with that.
Okay.
So, you know, if you're doing this as an interrogation, you're saying, hey, suspect, well, now I got a problem with, you know, now you're accusing me of this? Is that what you're saying?
We're trying to figure out what happened, Stephanie.
I'm just saying, you know, do I need to get a lawyer if you're a kid?
There is another reason why Matt McGough is so interested in the case of Stephanie Lazarus. He'd met her. While he was researching a story that involved art theft, that was her area of specialization, Matt went to see this police detective whose name later popped up in the news as a murder suspect.
Well, at the time, I had no idea, obviously, how things were going to unfold. I mean, it was, you know, remarkable, the interview, for how unremarkable it was. I went down to headquarters. This is April 2008. And I spoke with these two detectives, you know, really just about art theft. Fast forward a year, June 2009. And, you know, coincidentally, this is the beginning of what turned out to be the last season of Law & Order. So the writing staff, I was in my fourth season as a writer on the show, and we had gathered in the office of the head writer. And, you know, as was the custom for the show, you know, it was known for ripping headlines, I guess, is the term of art. So people are putting out crime stories that are in the news as fodder for episodes, potentially. And in that kind of round-robin environment, people throwing out ideas, one of my colleagues mentioned that he had heard on NPR that morning that a LAPD detective had been arrested for allegedly committing a cold case murder, and that, you know, that was from 1986, more than two decades in the past, and that she worked in art theft. And that immediately it was like, you know, everything kind of turned upside down for me in that moment because, you know, I knew that not only are there not many art theft detectives, but there was, you know, really only one female one. And I knew immediately that it could only have been Stephanie Lazarus.
So what did you say in the meeting?
I was flabbergasted. I mean, you know, you say, you know, you asked whether it was potentially a Law and Order episode. I mean, I was very, you know, I have quite a bit of experience at that point in terms of, you know, ripping headlines and turning crime stories into fiction. But I was really very curious from the beginning about this story as a nonfiction story and finding out the real story. It's not a simple story, and it's not a black and white story. And, you know, it's possible for, you know, if she did it and if she's convicted of it, you know, it doesn't mean that she wasn't a good police officer for many years. And, you know, there's a lot of good police work and determination on the part of not only, you know, all throughout the history of the case, from the criminalist who collected the bite mark swab that could not have been analyzed in 1986 through to the doggedness of the cold case unit itself, sifting through 9,000 cases, finding this, you know, needle in the haystack, and the way that the case was investigated in secret. It's just, you know, I think it's a lens through which you can look at how the LAPD has transformed itself over the past 25 years, how detective work has been transformed by science over the past 25 years. And, you know, ultimately that it's just, it's a very human, human story.
And I know Law and Order always says, you know, the following story is fictional. No actual person or event is depicted. Will we at some point see a version of a story like this?
You know, I can imagine how this story would be told in an episode of Law and Order, but I'm out for, you know, I want to tell the true story.
In this case, the facts are as fascinating as any fiction could be.
I think that's right. And, you know, I'm looking forward to watching the trial.
Matt McGough wrote a feature piece for The Atlantic about this case, and we have a link to that on our website at thestory.org. Stephanie Lazarus went to trial for murder this week in Los Angeles. The Story is produced this week by Phoebe Judge, Rachel McCarthy, Lauren Sporer, and Anita Woodley. Our engineers are Peter Bombar and Al Wadarski. Freddie Jenkins handles our quality control. Our interns are Kelsey Kirchman and Andre Fernandez. The Story's editor is Corey Princell. Our director is Carol Jackson. And our senior producer is Katie Davis. The Story is supported by the people who listen to WUNC, North Carolina Public Radio, at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. It's also supported through your contributions to your local public radio station. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
Support for The Story comes from the Redwoods Group Foundation, collaborating with Darkness to Light and local YMCAs to prevent child sexual abuse in America. D2L.org.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
And this is APM, American Public Media.